This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll learn how local performing arts groups are finding new ways to reach audiences.
So all of that unfolds out of a 26-foot box truck so that we can present performances at venues that would have otherwise not really been successful for classical music.
And we'll learn about a project at UC Santa Barbara that helps with decisions on reopening from the pandemic shutdown.
Anybody over the age of 52 was born when they had what was called the Hong Kong flu in 1968 and 1969. You're probably not familiar with it, right?
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 8th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Protests, demonstrations, and rallies across the Central Coast and nation continue for a second week after the police killing of George Floyd. One of the many issues brought out into the spotlight is the systemic racism that has shaped our cities over the past several decades. Our first segment looks at how that racism intersects with climate change. California's triple-digit heat is back. And new research shows residents in the state's most underserved neighborhoods suffer the most when the mercury rises. Cap Radio's Randall White has more.
New research shows residents that live in underserved neighborhoods really suffer the most when the mercury hits triple digits. But there are efforts underway to address this climate inequity. It's called heat mapping, and it's a research project that comes out of Portland State University. Volunteers attach GPS-equipped temperature collection gadgets to their cars and drive along set routes for an hour in the morning, afternoon, and evening. Last summer, they drove through the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Victorville, and Sacramento. Of those, the
hottest temperature was definitely Sacramento at 106.
That's project leader Professor Vivek Shandas. We met at a park near the state capitol.
We're trying to bring the understanding of climate change and the changes happening on a planetary scale down to the individual person and down to the individual city block.
He says the old way of measuring the temperatures by satellite doesn't provide an accurate picture of what people are feeling at street level.
What you're getting is rooftops, tops of trees, not the lived experience of what you and I standing in this park would actually experience.
So I decided to put one of these gadgets on my bike on one of last summer's hottest days and went out to get data from areas of Sacramento where cars can't go.
Okay, riding along the river now, and seriously, it feels cooler.
Fortunately, the American River Trail was a comfortable place that day and is an example of the temperature swings within a city, which can vary by as much as 20 degrees. Wealthy, tree-canopied neighborhoods are cooler, and low-income, asphalt-heavy communities hotter. Experts like urban sociologist Dr. Jesus Hernandez say decades of urban planning decisions are to blame for this disparity. We met near a Highway 99 overpass, so he could point out an example.
You see this freeway that we have here, because this is exactly the line of where race covenants stop. Oak Park, Curtis Park.
Hernandez says 99 serves as a barrier between rich and poor, and that was not an accident.
It was designed by race. All of our freeways were.
He also says the practice of denying loans, known as redlining, and legally prohibiting sales to people of color through restrictive covenants were big parts of the problem.
So you had a number of minorities who had means to buy properties who couldn't. Now you're like, where are we going to put all of these people, right? Because it's growing. And so this is where you see people having to move into neighborhoods that did not have race covenants. And Oak Park is one of them.
The result, a north-south corridor of poverty and race through Sacramento, where asphalt and concrete won out, and these neighborhoods get hot. This heat shows up in the data, too, with these redlined communities of color running, on average, 6 degrees hotter than the rest of the Sacramento area. But there's a new state project in the works to fix the problem in Sacramento and other cities. It's called Transformative Climate Communities, and Louise Bedsworth oversees it. She says Fresno is getting the first big chunk of money to protect low-income communities against rising temperatures.
We're investing $66.5 million. We're looking at an area that's connecting downtown Southwest Fresno and Chinatown.
She says the money will go toward affordable housing, businesses, eco-friendly transportation, and a new community college campus, all with more cooling trees and greenery.
It reduces the heat island effect, but it also makes it more likely that people can bike and walk and be outside and play.
Other projects are set for Ontario, Pacoima, Watts, and Sacramento. The money comes from the state's cap and trade program because the projects are also designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There are hundreds more of these heat island communities in California, however, and temperatures are only expected to climb in the years to come.
That was Randall White reporting in Sacramento. Thousands marched through the streets of Santa Barbara yesterday, particularly along State Street, some of which is now closed to traffic. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with Peter Rupert, who heads the Economic Forecast Project at UC Santa Barbara. The project collects data and statistics that help people make more informed decisions. And it and Rupert are actively involved in Santa Barbara County's reopening after the pandemic shutdown.
What is the Economic Forecast Project?
The Economic Forecast Project started 30-some years ago. I took it over about 10 years ago. The Forecast Project is a source that collects data for the community, tries to analyze various aspects of the economy, and tries to provide information for policymakers, real estate, banks, and the populace.
Okay, got it. And you recently had a webinar specifically about reopening after the pandemic shutdown. Can you just kind of, people who didn't tune into that, can you give us a breakdown of everything you talked about? And
sure. So as everyone knows, that, you know, the economy came crushing down with a sledgehammer hit it. And then there's been lots of controversy on, you know, how to open, when to open. The initial rules were pretty blanket across all different communities, even though some had fewer illnesses, fewer deaths, and would be prepared. So I'm on the mayor's task force here in Santa Barbara on reopening. And the idea was, how do we understand, once the governor opens up the economy, are people really going to go back? And that was the main focus, thinking about, are people going to go to movie theaters in the near future? Are they going to travel? What are they going to do about tourism? And then the idea was that in order to maintain social distancing, we talked about how restaurants, for example, or retail firms can practice social distancing. And out of that whole discussion basically came the idea that's been floating around for a long time as to closing down State Street to autos. And so once the vehicles are off the road, restaurants, for example, are able to have tables outside, because I think, as most people know, that if you have to social distance within a restaurant and you tell the restaurants they have to remove half of the tables or a third of the tables, you know, restaurants are already on pretty thin margins trying to survive at full capacity. And so this enables them to move to the outside to maintain social distancing and still, you know, be able to run a business. So we talked to Paul Casey, the city administrator here, and Bob Stout, who's the president of the Downtown Association, and just try to get a sense of how everyone's faring. And we've already seen some bankruptcies in restaurants and retail shops. And that's probably going to continue for a while, but we try to understand what it is that the city could do and business could do to alleviate that.
So that's great for the restaurants that are on State Street that already are able to afford probably a pretty high rent. What about all the other restaurants that aren't on State Street and don't benefit from that social distancing room?
Right, that's a great question. And they did think about that. And the idea is that these restaurants that are not able to do that, they're establishing what are called parklets. And so on the side streets, for example, or other streets where they have parking, the city's allowing those types of restaurants or retail outlets to use up some of the parking spaces that are out there, for example, for some tables, chairs, to be able to sit out there. They're not going to be able to go into the street, but they can pretty much stay inside the parking areas. And all those things are going to be worked out slowly over time.
And is State Street closed now?
Yes, it is. It's closed from Haley to up to Sola. So it's the 500 block up to the 1200 block. So those 8 blocks are closed to traffic, yes. And then the other part of it is, even though there's no vehicles on there, there are bikes. And so, you know, it's one of those things, the idea from the city council and the city administrator was, you know, let's get it open, let's get people social distancing, and then we'll fix all the small problems as they come.
Was there a sunset date on this closure of State Street, or is this going to be going on for a while?
I think this is going to go on for a while. There was nothing to say that it was going to end, you know, in July or August. I think it's going to be there for a while. And if it works like many people hope it will work, you know, I could imagine that they would make it somehow more permanent. If we're seeing much more life down on State Street and businesses are able to survive, you know, they're going to have to rethink the having cars on there. So we talked a whole wide range of things, like how fast can we get to the next stage? What's going on in the health sector? Are we overwhelming our hospitals, intensive care? And try to get a sense of how to appeal to the governor. As I mentioned, at first it was just a blanket rule for everyone. And then once things started to calm down a little bit, individual counties could apply to explain their case as to there aren't many deaths, we have a lot of capacity. But the other interesting piece here is this really wasn't coordinated across county. We talked a little bit about that, which is Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, places like that, they rely a lot on tourism, not solely, but a lot on tourism. And so while LA was still shut down, and maybe it's going to be shut down for a little bit longer than Santa Barbara, public health was worried that a lot of people from LA would be traveling to Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, et cetera, to go to restaurants and basically have little vacations. And so I think public health was, we're going to be super careful on getting people to tourists who may be in more infected areas coming here. So I think they're going to keep hotels at limited capacity, those kinds of things.
Why do you think that this particular pandemic has resulted in this unprecedented change in the way that we do pretty much everything?
Right. That's a great question. Anybody over the age of 52 was born when they had what was called the Hong Kong flu in 1968 and 1969. You're probably not familiar with it, right? Never probably even heard of it, but you have heard of it.
No, I never heard of it.
Right. But you heard of the Spanish flu, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the last pandemic where thousands of people that died.
So in 1968 to 1970, during the Hong Kong flu, 100,000 people in the United States died. Okay. In 1957 and 58, that was called the Asian flu, 116,000 people died. Now, what did they do? Woodstock took place during the pandemic. For example, they didn't shut anything down. There were some precautions taken in hospitals. There was no government shutdown. The Federal Reserve didn't do anything. The Treasury didn't do anything. And you don't really see it in the economics. You don't see it in the data. You don't see it in unemployment rates. You don't see it in GDP, you know, none of those things. Now, that's not to say had they shut down, they could have protected more lives. So we don't have that kind of counterfactual, right? We don't know. Just like today, if they didn't shut down, you know, we don't really know how many lives would be lost. But the point is, back in 57, 58, and 68, 69, we just had a much, much different view of how to handle these things. And so today, I think what happened was there were some hot spots that got hit hard. And then people really, really worried in these areas, you know, in Italy and a few places like that. And, you know, the press came out with expectations of maybe up to 2 million people dying. And I think the first reaction was, we got to shut down. Do we think now that was the right way to do it? No, I don't think most people, and a lot of economists have worked on this with health officials. The most at-risk people are older people and, you know, those with pre-existing conditions. And so what should have happened, rather than a sledgehammer, they should have said, listen, get the people who are most at risk, stay home. We can keep open a lot of things that people have to socially distance themselves, but, you know, we can keep those kind of things open. And so, you know, the other part of this to me and what I've been explaining to our public health officials is, I know you're thinking about COVID deaths, but the longer this economy is shut down and the longer is low-wage individuals not at work, we've already seen increases in calls to suicide hotlines. We'll see alcoholism increase. We've seen domestic abuse increase. We, you know, all these things happen because people are out of work, very, you know, they don't have any money. And so if you take a bigger picture of things, no one here, at least I'm not, talking about a trade-off between opening up business and at the risk of infecting more people. That's not at all where I'm coming from. And I think most people, you know, it's like we can do this in a safe way, make sure the people who are at high risk are taken care of. But for young people, typically, this is a bad case of the flu. And so, again, it's a huge debate, hard to say. So it's not clear why we kind of overreacted here. But again, if we didn't, we just don't have that counterfactual how many people would have died.
That was Peter Rupert, director of the Economic Forecast Project at UC Santa Barbara, speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. Nonprofit organizations play an essential role in our communities on the Central Coast. Consuelo Mutes is CEO of Spokes, which for a membership fee provides resources for nonprofits, like training and consulting for board members, staff, and volunteers aiming to boost expertise and efficiency. Today, Mutes brings us a conversation on the performing arts with guests from Opera Slow and the Clark Center for the Performing Arts in Arroyo Grande.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes. I am the CEO of Spokes, Resources for Nonprofits. We are the nonprofit resource center for the SLO County area, as well as other counties, with our members coming from as far away as Chicago, Illinois, and as close as San Francisco, as well as our county. So for some of you that don't know us, our whole mission is to help to guide other nonprofits to reach their goals through support in our expert resources. We are located in San Luis Obispo. We thank you for coming to the Nonprofit Story. Our whole purpose is for you to know more about the nonprofits within SLO County and beyond and what they are doing to serve the social and economic fabric of our county community. Today, I'm so excited to have with us to speak to you during this time of COVID-19, two people who have been really central in helping the arts and music nonprofit community over the years. I have Dr. Brian Aldehoff, and I have Connie O'Henley, and both will be telling us a little bit about their nonprofit story as we go forward. I just want to quickly introduce Dr. Aldehoff. Brian Asher Aldehoff, he has been the artistic and general director of Opera San Luis Obispo since 2011, and he is also the artistic director and conductor of the Lompoc Pops Orchestra, in addition to principal conductor for the Civic Ballet of San Luis Obispo and State Street Ballet in Santa Barbara. Dr. Aldehoff is also a consultant arts coordinator for the San Luis Obispo County Office of Education, where he is responsible for producing arts outreach throughout the county. He has, since 1985, been the conductor of Opera San Luis Obispo, which is the region's only professional opera company and one of only a few grand opera producing companies in the state of California. I also want to introduce Connie O'Henley. Connie is the executive director of the Clark Center for the Performing Arts. She's been the executive director of the Clark Center Association in Arroyo Grande since 2007. And prior to that, she was with the Central Coast Salmon Enhancement and the YMCA. Many of you, I'm sure, know the Clark Center for the Performing Arts. It is a premier venue for world-class professional performing arts in an intimate setting located in Arroyo Grande High School campus. So welcome, Dr. Brian and Connie. So we wanted to have you on this afternoon on the Nonprofit Story because so much is happening in our community because of the coronavirus situation and particularly the sheltering in place. And I know that you have been very, very involved with the arts and music community as a whole, not just for your own organizations, but for the whole sector. So I'd like to start with Dr. Brian. And have you just tell us a little bit about your involvement with the arts community. You can talk to us about Opera Slow and you're involved with so many other things and some of the major issues that you may have faced during this pandemic.
Well, thank you so much again for having me. Pleasure to be on your show and to finally get a chance to meet you. I would love to just start off by saying I'm so happy to know that I'm joined by Connie at the Clark Center, which was where I actually made my debut in Central Coast. Back in 2010, I brought a touring group to San Luis Obispo on behalf of Opera San Luis Obispo to perform Gilbert and Sullivan's The Yeoman of the Guard. We just had a great time at the Clark Center, and we've been back a few times for outreach and other events, and it's just it's a great theater. There's a lot of stuff that's going on right now because of COVID-19, and it's unfortunate that the arts have not been invited to discussions on how California will be reopened. But I'm not surprised in the sense that the arts, and especially the live performing arts, do sort of represent the pinnacle of social activity as a as a culture. What do we do the most together? Well, sports and arts. We go to football games and we go to operas. So it's only reasonable to imagine that by the time we can get back into a football game or an opera performance, we'll have to be quite beyond a vaccine. At least that's what a lot of surveys are sort of reporting back that our audience members are feeling. By process of elimination and just the product that we produce, it's obvious that we're last in line for coming back to normal. We've had to cancel a number of events. We've had to postpone a number of events. But whether it's cancellation or postponement, the difficult part is how audiences are going to return to the pattern of attending events prior to a vaccine and after a vaccine. We just don't know. And the response to surveys have been very, very low so far. So it's difficult to base a major budgetary decision on such a small return of information. So we're sort of guessing. In my situation, production may cost $150,000 to $180,000. So we have to really have a good feel for how the economy is going to respond to a show. We are very much reliant upon ticket sales to recoup our production costs. So we have to produce things that the audience will respond well to. With COVID-19, that presents an issue. We've also had to cancel and postpone many of our fundraiser events, which has limited the availability of income.
So you are a nonprofit organization. I think people don't always understand that. And so you do depend on people coming in and helping you out. You'd mentioned your productions. Would you just give us one or two titles or names of what type of productions you do?
We're a very active grand opera producing company. We're one of just a few in the state of California, and we have evolved over the last 10 years to incorporate a number of different kinds of performance variances that are representative of successful business models from our supportive arts organization. So what does all that babble mean? Well, we produce musicals, we produce symphonic pops, we do Broadway shows, we have a lot of Broadway, and in addition to just fun activities. I like to say in appreciative circles, we're not your grandparents' opera company. Most people would know us from our recent grand production of South Pacific last October 2019. Prior to that, we had produced fantastic Magic Flute in 2018. In 2017, we did Madame Butterfly. 2016 was a double feature of, 2018 was the double feature of Oklahoma in the Spring.
You did the really big opera productions here. So we're fortunate to have you here on the Central Coast. It's very unusual. And a lot of those now that you have planned for the future apparently cannot happen. So what have you done to kind of shift right now and to maintain your relevancy and stay operational?
We pretty much hopped immediately onto the social media stream. We've released a number of videos that are anywhere from full productions. We're up to our 17th episode of a chime-in video with an artist or company member from the past. And those are short 3 to 5 minute videos where we basically ask our artists, what are you doing? How are you coping with COVID-19 issue? How are you keeping yourself busy? I just sort of leave it at that. Several of the artists on their own have responded with performances for us. So we're obviously not paying for these videos. So it's really a demonstration of the innate nature of artists to have to perform. We need to perform. We do what we do, not because we're looking for fame and money. I mean, that's great if it happens, but we're doing this because there's something inside of us that has to come out and sing.
And I've seen several of those, and they're so well done, and they're very entertaining.
We've also got some things in the process at the unveiling of our mobile opera house, which has been a 2.5-year project. We purchased a 26-foot box truck and had a senior class engineering team at Cal Poly collaborate in inventing a backdrop, an acoustically projecting backdrop, and we also purchased a significant stage. So all of that unfolds out of a 26-foot box truck so that we can present performances at venues that would have otherwise not really been successful for classical music ensembles, such as Mid-State Fair, the Farmers Market, beach events. But it also gives us an opportunity to drive a truck onto the campus of a school and unpack a stage and put on a lunchtime quad show for kids in a way that would really gather attention. It's one thing to stand with a microphone and a speaker, and it's another thing for a 26-foot box truck to implode on your campus.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between Consuelo Mutes, CEO of Spokes, and Brian Asher Oladef of Opera Slow, and Connie O'Henley of the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande.
So Connie, we want to get you in on this now. Speaking about venues at the Clark Center, you house many of the productions that happen in the arts and music community. How have you been affected by this pandemic situation?
It's been an interesting time for sure. We have over 300 events a year, and those events range everywhere from business symposiums to school projects to professional touring shows to community touring shows like the opera. And so we've had to cancel over 100 events. Wow. We've had over 1,000 patrons holding tickets. And as a management program, we don't typically refund tickets. That's not usually part of our process. So we've had to develop communication streams and accounting processes to manage in $100,000 worth of refunds that we've issued thus far. So from a financial and a business standpoint, it's been a little bit challenging, but we're managing through that, and we really appreciate all of our patrons that have been patient with us and that have, you know, helped us out. Bright light in all of this is we've had a tremendous amount of really generous donors that have come forward that haven't always been donors in the past. So that's been exciting.
So you have not been able to have any of your performances there. Have you been able to do anything else as far as getting ready for reopening or finding out how you're going to continue in the future over at Clark Center?
We are working towards having some smaller events. We've had some groups want to film some performances on the stage. So we're working on a reopening plan for that type of an event. We are working on a reopening plan for a mid-size event in that 100 range. We do have a church that meets here or used to meet here on Sundays, and so we're working with them. And then, you know, looking forward to the time when we can be at least a quarter or half of our normal capacity and what that's going to look like, because that's going to be a huge financial impact on not only operations-wise, but from the renter standpoint. What does a ticket price need to be if you only have 300 seats to fill instead of 600 seats that you can fill? Does it mean two performances in a day that has the same capacity of 600 people, but it takes a little bit longer to do? So lots of different creative ways to figure out how we can get people in here and enjoying the arts and enjoying the arts together as a community.
And it sounds like you're really taking care to think about how to keep people safe for when they return.
Absolutely. You know, there's lots of protocols that we're going to be putting in place. Some of them are going to be required by our county and state government. But then there's also a lot of protocols that we're going to put in place our patrons are interested in us doing. We've been doing some surveying like everybody else and asking our patrons, what's going to make you feel comfortable? It's different for each of our patrons. And so trying to find a place that's going to make it easy for them to come back in. And in the meantime, if they're not comfortable coming back in, figuring out a way that we can maybe stream a show at the same time or provide content of that same show at the same time for those who aren't ready to leave their houses yet.
That's a lot to consider and a lot of work that the nonprofit agency is having to do that the people in the community may not really understand you have to go through to get this moving. So, Dr. Brian, how are you working with bringing the opera back to the stage for live performances or other types of performances that you've always been able to produce?
Well, a lot of our planning is incumbent upon how California actually reopens. However, one initiative that I'm in the process of trying to develop with a number of nonprofit leaders is what I'm calling the PAXLO Audience Sustainability Fund. The general idea behind that is we'd like to take the resident companies that are housed at Performing Arts Center San Luis Obispo. So for example, the Opera San Luis Obispo, San Luis Obispo Symphony, San Luis Obispo Youth Symphony, Civic Ballet, Ballet Theater SLO, a number of other organizations, and determine under normal conditions how many shows would they produce between September of this year and December 31st of next year. And then what would the ticket revenue be from sold out shows? And then try to reach out to some donors that would cover at least 50% of that production. So that what we could do is, for a number of reasons, if we had this fund available where if every resident company was given 50% of their ticket revenue ahead of time, that would encourage them to still produce given a number of possible outcomes. And some of those outcomes might be, well, the government may say live performance can happen with only 30% capacity, and then that might increase to 50%. And even if the government does release our ability to perform at 100%, then what happens? When will audiences feel comfortable coming back at 100%? Basically, what we're trying to establish is a fund that would cover resident companies at Performing Arts Center San Luis Obispo for about a year, which is my sort of estimate as to, I'll bet by 2022, assuming we don't have any major pandemics or apocalyptic events, we should be back to normal. Should be.
So it could take that long, possibly.
It could. I mean, you know, we're the last people on the block to really see a return. So that's one possibility. Of course, we're also exploring live performances via online that would be broadcast for possible monetization. However, that's difficult as well. Some organizations are doing that now successfully. Some are trying to do it and then failing and having to cancel events. So the technology is not quite up to the ability to serve us at this point in time at a reasonable financial investment.
I think that one of the wonderful things that you're saying, and I want to really emphasize, is that you're working in a collaborative manner with each other, it seems, out in the art and music industry in order, or the sector out there in San Luis Obispo County, in order to bring all of this to the patrons.
You know, it's in my business, it's all about collaboration. Opera is the Olympics of classical music. It's the stage where all the performance genres come together: orchestra, singers, soloists, the design arts of scene, costume, and set lighting. When one of those areas loses a leg, you know, we feel it. And if all of those areas lose a leg, we're out of business, you know. Yeah. So, you know, and also, especially in this small community, we are all involved in each other. Every single orchestra is staffed by almost exactly the same people. Every chorus is staffed by the same singers. Concert venue has a roving troupe of staff that, you know, people who work at the PAC, work at the Clark Center, work at the Vina Robles Amphitheater, go down to Chumash Casino. So we're a very close-knit family here, not to mention that our donors, they're repeat donors at all of these events. In a larger city like Los Angeles, there's much less crossover. But in San Luis Obispo, you can expect to see a lot of familiar faces, from musical theater to rock and roll to opera to symphony.
Connie, I wonder if there's anything you want to add about this right now.
Well, we're looking forward to having people back in. You know, we have 180 volunteers. We're a community organization. We serve the community. We're enjoyed by the community. We're utilized by the community. And so we have a lot of community members out there that I think really want to get back in and participate and help out and are trying to figure out how. And so our job at the Clark Center is really to figure that out. How can we get back in here safely, make sure that we meet all of the expectations of our patrons, help those presenters that want to get back in here unfold this puzzle, because it's a giant puzzle. When you really start getting into what reopening looks like and operating a center, and how many touch points you have. But we're excited to be able to be moving forward and continuing to serve a need in the community.
Dr. Brian, how can people get in touch with you, or where should they look for your artist clips?
One of the things we're doing right now that we're hoping to benefit from this period of downtime is we're starting a 1,000 subscribers campaign So I would love to direct folks to go to youtube.com and search OPERASLO. That's Opera Slow at YouTube, where you can see almost 90 videos that we've posted over the last 10 years and many over the last month. Outside of that, we're at www.operaslow.org.
Connie, what about you? People want to be in touch.
You can certainly go to our website at clarkcenter.org or follow our Facebook page and Instagram at Clark Center. We are working on a virtual summer concert series to get people engaged and involved. So certainly sign up for our email list or get on our Facebook page to keep abreast of that. We have a YouTube channel as well. So we're out there and pulling together all the fun things that we've done over the past and planning for a great future.
Well, I want to thank both of the guests today on the Nonprofit Story, Dr. Brian Asher Al-Hadaf and Connie O'Henley with the Clark Center and Dr. Brian with the Opera Slow. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mewks. I'm the CEO of Spokes, Resources for Nonprofits. You can find us at spokesfornonprofits.org or drop me an email at ceo@spokesfornonprofits.org. And thank you for joining us on this episode of The Nonprofit Story.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. We will now return with Issues and Ideas. KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer traveled to Little Rock, Arkansas in 2016 and recorded an interview with Robin White of the National Park Service. She spoke from the heart about why Black Lives Matter and the best hope for the future. Given the national conversation at the moment, we're interested in listening again to White's perspective. This interview initially aired on KCBX in 2017.
When I stopped in to visit with Robin White, the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, I had no idea that our conversation in her office would lead so quickly to tears. I had interviewed Miss White a couple years ago, and at the time we stayed on track, keeping the focus surrounding the September 1957 events at Little Rock Central High School. On this visit, I decided on the spur of the moment to change the focus if she was amenable. I said, let's talk about lessons learned, but more importantly, lessons not learned in the intervening six decades. I had no idea that my entree would open the floodgates of her soul. The subsequent conversation quickly had tears running down Miss White's cheeks and mine too. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Miss White's office in Little Rock, Arkansas, as she shares her profound, powerful thoughts and feelings that she confessed are way too often regretfully stuffed and suppressed.
Yeah.
Robin White.
Good morning. My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, a unit of the National Park Service, which was established in 1998. It was established to commemorate school desegregation and the Little Rock Nine. 60 years ago, you had nine Afro-American students that had this ideology about equality and wanting to pursue an equal education. That was 60 years ago, and the struggle continues.
One would think that we would have made some progress since 1957, and one would think that a lot of things that happened in the 50s and before would have been history. And yet we see some of the endemic racism within society and communities still rising their ugly head.
There's a term that I call space occupants apology, whereas we're constantly apologizing for our existence. It seems like we need permission for our existence, people of color. And you look at how society prescribe, and I call it a society prescription, prescribe how we are supposed to perceive or see each other. We don't see each other in totality. We see each other by color, by economics, by class. We do not see each other in the eye of humanity. And with this come so many faults and struggles, whereas many of us want to stand in our convictions and just be ourselves and perceived as a human being, but we are labeled and put into boxes. And lately, sad to say that we have become a footnote. When you watch TV, you see the news, and all these senseless lives are taken. When you take a life, you're taking a generation. You're taking generations of what's to come. You're wiping that out. You're wiping out that seed. And you're looking at the news, and here you see another man lost his life, and it's basically a footnote. And that's what we have become. And we are better than that. We are supposed to be better than that. We're supposed to be bigger than that. Why? Why is my dark skin a sin? Why am I looked at as different? We're all different. That's the beauty of us. That is why we were created. All this difference is what make all of us so wonderful. But to the core of me, I should not be struggling to be accepted. I should not be struggling for someone to see me in my totality. And it is so painful. I don't think people understand what it means to get up every day. We can't take this skin off of us. This is who we are. I value myself, and I know my worth, but others don't see that. They don't see my worth. They don't value me. We don't value each other. And with that, we are doing a disservice to each other. We are doing a disservice to the next generation, to our children, because they see that. How can we ready them? How can we prepare them to make decisions for our future when we are making all these bad decisions ourselves?
It seems to me that explains so much for that momentum and that reason for Black Lives Matter, exactly what you're talking about.
People say all lives matter, and they do. But when you are losing a life every day, back to back, my brothers and sisters are just dropping. there's something wrong when people don't see. This has been going on since we've been here. The only difference now is that we have social media, that it's in real time. And no one would have believed it if we did not have social media. We would be perceived as liars, basically, that we're making this up. And still people, some people are still in denial. They could see it, but it's, sometimes it's just too much for them to wrap their head around, and they continue to deny it. We need a voice, yes. So when Black Lives Matter come into existence, there is a purpose. There is a purpose. When we are looking to stand in our convictions, there's something that I believe in. Not only do I have a purpose, but we also must live on purpose. And we can't live on purpose if our lives are continually snuffed out. We can't live on purpose and make a difference if we are dropping like flies and no one is held accountable, or no one can see what's really going on because they are too blind, or they are just in denial because it's just too much. Black Lives Matter exists for a reason, and we need that. We need the support. We need the support of people that are not of color. We need people, just like during the movement, you had people from all across the nation, different denominations, ethnicities, everyone came together. We need that same support to overcome this. This hump, this is a big hump to overcome this. And we're not saying that all policemen are bad, but in every group, there is going to be a bad core. There is going to be a bad apple. And the only way to flush it out is for those, his colleagues, to step up and stand up and say, you do not represent me. You know, in the National Park Service, we wear our uniform with pride, the green and gray. We wear it with pride. And we have over 400 units, whereas we represent the story of a people. We're here to protect and preserve our natural resources. The same thing is that police officers are here to protect and preserve. You can't protect me if you fear me. You can't protect me if you are afraid. If you are afraid of me, and I can't see you, if I'm afraid of you, all I see is fear. And I fear for our children. I fear for my people. And this is heavy, very heavy on my heart. But not only my heart, all of us, we're all carrying this weight, and we should not have to. This belongs to all of us, and we all have a responsibility to each other.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is speaking with Robin White, National Park Service Superintendent at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site.
What is your best feeling and idea for going forward, for exactly what you're talking about, for your children, for the future? How do we rise? How do we grow?
I think first, some of us have to admit that we're dealing with manufactured fear. A lot of this is synthetic fear. And this manufactured fear can no longer be justifiable to take a life. You cannot use this as an excuse to take a life. How can we see each other in totality if we fear each other? We have to have conversations. I think one of the greatest things that we can do is actually not only have training on sensitivity in our communities with law enforcement, but also with our residents. All of us need to be exposed to the struggle of a people and looking at civil rights. I don't think it should be one side. It needs to be both sides for us to understand each other. We need to come to that medium whereas we could have conversations. You can't continue to fear me. We have to develop some respect for each other or with each other to move forward. We can't keep using excuses. I think that once upon a time, we knew who our police officers were. They knew is that our families in the community knew each other. And the policemen were part of our family. That no longer exists. They're not part of our family. And you have this code, this culture. Well, we all have a culture. And if we could find a way to break down some of those social and culture barriers, we could cross those thresholds and see each other and respect each other and work together. The communities belong to all of us. Like even as a park ranger or as a superintendent, my job is to serve the community and learn what their needs are. How can I serve them if I don't have a relationship with them? How can I give them or develop programs that are relevant to them if I don't have a relationship with them? And it's the same thing. We have to work together and get to know each other to diminish those social and culture barriers.
You are actually doing that here. I saw your brochure on some of your presenters and whatnot to do that outreach and to have people from Black Lives Matter come here and talk. So this really is an important community center in a sense right here. Your National Park site.
It is very important because we belong to the community. Community raised me. And with community raising me, I'm here to serve the community. The National Park Service is a vessel for me to serve the community and provide a forum for people to tell their narratives. We don't own their stories. My job is to provide a venue, a forum for them to tell, for the residents to tell their story, to write their own narratives. That's my job. That's my responsibility. And with that, opening those doors, more doors open. And we're making that connection, whereas it's a shame, and we're linked, 1, 2, 3, we're all working together. And that's what I see as being a servant and being a servant leader or being a servant to the community, for the community to tell me what they want and me to work with them to deliver what they want and making sure that it's relevant to them.
Robin, in your life, as you look back and you look forward, has there been progress sociologically, community-wise, that you've seen in your life, or has it been kind of a stasis?
Of course, there has been progress in different parts of the community. And even with me, I would say growing up with my parents were sharecroppers coming from a Mexican plantation in Slaughter, Mississippi. Growing up in the bayous, growing up in the low country. So I've always been of the earth. I've always been of the earth and connected to the earth as far as looking at where I come from. And so we all belong. It's the problem is many of us struggle to be accepted or to belong. If you don't know who you are, if you have no foundation, it makes it even harder. But yes, there has been tremendous progress, but that does not mean that we can't do better. We must do better.
Looking forward, looking to the future, what is your best hope and how do we rise to that next level?
Step by step, we have to own this, I don't want to say monster, but there is some darkness here. How can we move toward the light if we don't even admit or own that darkness that we're standing in, that we're sitting in? And then moving forward, we have to admit what is going on, own that, and then look at solutions. And it takes all of us. It can't be one person too. It takes all of us from the community. That means law enforcement. That means special services. That means social organizations, social justice organizations. All of us have to work together. The bad part about this is that...
In which ways are y'all working together now?
We have town hall gatherings right here at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We are having those conversations right here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. We have the FBI, local FBI, that will come in and have conversations with the community. But they contacted us because this is what they want to do, and this is what they want to be a part of, solutions, looking at how we can move forward. We've had conversations, a program called Conversations of Color, and talking about from Alabama, from or Birmingham to today, and looking at our progress, where we were then and where we are now. We have to do it step by step, but it is so important to own it. We have to admit that there are some problems. We have to admit we're not perfect. And then come together to have that dialogue and looking for solutions. In November of last year, we had what we call a social conscious gathering where people from across the country, even from Northern Ireland came, all of us came together. And we were talking about religious divide. We were talking about economic inequality. We were talking about the education system and how it is going. We're regressing. It's becoming separate again. But not equal. And so we could talk about the problems, but we also must look at solutions. And it is our responsibility to go back into our communities. And so you had Dr. Habrowski, the president of Maryland University. You had Dr. Herschel from the Jewish community. You had rabbis. You had people from the Muslim community, Islamic. All of us came together. People that were connected to Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland, all of us came together. We had youth from Philander Smith College, from Arkansas Baptist, and people came from as far as Boston. But all of us came together to talk about the here and now. The American Indian Movement, we had the American Indian Movement and the FBI in the same room. And we were talking about how we can move forward.
Wow. Robin White, thank you so much. Absolute pleasure to be with you.
You're most welcome, and I appreciate it.
That was Robin White of the National Park Service in conversation with correspondent Tom Wilmer in an interview recorded in 2016. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.